This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, February 29th, 2012. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up in Washington, lawmakers debate a measure that would prevent the indefinite detention of American citizens under a controversial national defense law.
It is a central strategy of al-Qaeda to recruit U.S. persons to carry out attacks against the United States. The threat of homegrown terrorists acting in concert with foreign organizations is likely to increase.
What about someone in the wrong place at the wrong time that gets picked up, held without charge or trial until the end of hostilities? And who knows when these hostilities end?
Occupy protesters take action in cities across the U.S. to draw attention to corporate influence in politics. And we'll go to Cambodia to speak with an American-raised refugee who was deported. He's part of an exile community advocating for a change in U.S. policy.
I was the product. They made a product and decided that this product is no good and shipped me out there with nothing. And to me, how inhumane it is that it's a death sentence.
That and more coming up after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. Today in Syria, there are widespread reports of a ground offensive against rebel-held neighborhoods in Homs. U.S. diplomats are drafting a new Security Council resolution that focuses on humanitarian efforts and calls for a stop to the violence. Officials are trying to woo support from Russia and China, who previously voted against a resolution they said called for regime change. In other developments, the Syrian government has barred the top UN humanitarian official, Valerie Amos, from visiting the country. The UN updated its death toll estimates, with one official saying certainly well over 7,500 people have died since the Syrian uprising began. Today in Russia, the St. Petersburg city government passed a bill prohibiting what lawmakers refer to as the propaganda of homosexuality. Activists say the bill may be broadly applied to prohibit any public activities by gays and lesbians. FSRN's Yekaterina Danilova reports.
The bill received support from the ruling party United Russia and the Communist Party, while other parties did not vote. Only one party, Yabloko, voted against the bill. Protests took place in various European cities and New York on Tuesday, with people threatening not to visit St. Petersburg if the law goes into effect. Olga Lenkova is communications director with the LGBT group Coming Out. She says religious arguments have been central to passage of the bill.
You know, Apostle Paul has said this and this about homosexuality. So we don't really know how we can have a real argument, a real discussion about these things with people who just draw arguments from Bible and not from modern science.
The mayor has previously stated support for the bill and is likely to sign it into law. LGBT groups are vowing to fight the law in court and through popular protest. Yekaterina Danilova, FSRN, St. Petersburg, Russia.
North Korea has agreed to halt long-range missile launches, nuclear tests, and uranium enrichment. The U.S. State Department announced today the country will also allow IAEA nuclear inspectors to return and confirm the agreed-to halting of nuclear activities. The U.S. calls this agreement progress, but says it still has profound concerns. The U.S. is preparing to ship nearly a 250,000 tons of food aid to North Korea. Just before tomorrow's launch of Google's new privacy policy that would expand its use of users' personal data, the French Data Protection Agency has told the company the plan may violate European privacy laws. From France, FSRN's Liam Moriarty has more.
Google says the new privacy policy will streamline and simplify users' experience by sharing data across its dozens of online services, such as YouTube, Gmail, and Google Maps, as well as its popular search engine. But in a letter to Google CEO Larry Page, French data protection authorities say they're deeply concerned about the plan and have strong doubts about its legality. Jan Padova is with CNIL, the French Data Protection Agency.
We think that this new policy may be more simple and to some extent is less transparent because you have no real insight of what data are collected, for what purpose, and for which application.
Kneale was asked by the data protection agencies in all 27 EU countries to evaluate Google's new privacy policy on their behalf. The agency's findings could mean problems for Google across the continent. European authorities, as well as some digital privacy groups in Europe and the U.S., have asked Google to postpone launching the new policy. Google has declined, saying they're confident they've adequately explained the changes to their users. Liam Moriarty, FSRN, Normandy, France.
Republican presidential hopeful Mitt Romney has fended off a stiff challenge from Rick Santorum in Michigan's primary. Romney will split the state's delegates with Santorum. Romney also won in Arizona, where the delegates are awarded on a winner-take-all basis. The case of disbarred civil rights lawyer Lynn Stewart was before a New York appeals court today. Her lawyer is challenging a 2010 decision to increase her sentence from 2 years and 4 months to 10 years in prison. A court convicted Stewart in 2005 of providing material support to terrorists while she represented an Egyptian cleric. In a statement on her website today, Stewart said she believed the 10-year sentence is, quote, based on a foundation of sand. Stewart is currently in federal prison in Texas. And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. In Washington today, a Senate committee considered a bill that would prevent the indefinite detention of American citizens. The bill is in response to the controversial National Defense Authorization Act, or NDAA, which President Obama signed into law late last year. Tuesday night, the president published a memo that waives some of the most controversial provisions of the NDAA, including mandatory indefinite military detention. But some legal experts warn that a future administration could still abuse the powers the NDAA provides. FSRN's Alice Olstein has the details in Washington, D.C.
Seattle University law professor Lorraine Benai grew up hearing her parents and grandparents recall their traumatic forced internment at Manzanar, where thousands of Japanese Americans were held for years without charge during World War II.
They were rounded up because our country feared attack. There were unfounded suspicions that some were spies, and they looked like the enemy.
On Wednesday morning, Benai told the Senate Judiciary Committee that the National Defense Authorization Act, which officially takes effect later this week, lays the framework for similar abuses in the future.
The World War II incarceration teaches us about human frailty during times of crisis. We are thus warned to safeguard constitutional protections, particularly in times when fear and racism can infect responsible judgment.
Benai testified in support of the Due Process Guarantee Act, which would amend the National Defense Authorization Act, or NDAA, to ensure that no U.S. citizen or green card holder is detained without charge or trial. California Democrat Dianne Feinstein wrote and sponsored the bill. At Wednesday's hearing, she explained why the NDAA's detention provisions, designed to catch supporters of terrorism, go too far.
What about an innocent American like Fred Korematsu or other Japanese Americans during World War II? What about someone in the wrong place at the wrong time that gets picked up, held without charge or trial until the end of hostilities? And who knows when these hostilities end?
Echoing these and other concerns, the White House published a memo Tuesday night waiving the mandatory military custody provision in almost all cases. But Shahid Buttar from the Bill of Rights Defense Committee says it's not a permanent or complete fix.
The greatest concern is simply that they don't bind future administrations, and the fact that the next administration could interpret its authority under the NDAA in much more expansive terms is a matter of grave concern to Americans across the political spectrum, because it basically creates a still ongoing possibility that this statute could be used as an instrument of profound and disturbing political oppression.
The waiver does not include non-citizens apprehended in the U.S., leaving them vulnerable to indefinite military detention without charge. Former Justice Department official Stephen Bradbury criticized both the president's waiver and Feinstein's bill, S-2003. He argued that the NDAA's detention provisions are necessary in extraordinary circumstances, and called extending due process to U.S. citizens and legal permanent residents a burden.
Such a burden could seriously impede our ability to defend the nation from attack in extraordinary circumstances when the threat facing the country is acute and there is a need to act with urgency. It is a central strategy of al-Qaeda to recruit U.S. persons to carry out attacks against the United States. The threat of homegrown terrorists acting in concert with foreign organizations is likely to increase. Unfortunately, S-2003 would have the effect of reducing the flexibility of the United States to respond to that growing threat.
Bradbury was one of the Bush administration officials who authorized waterboarding, sleep deprivation, and other forms of torture in violation of international law. A 2009 report by the Office of Professional Responsibility found that Bradbury and his fellow lawyers did not act in good faith when they gave the legal go-ahead for torture methods already being used. At the hearing, Minnesota Democrat Al Franken told Bradbury that his past ethics violations call his current testimony into question.
It's very difficult for me, frankly, to rely on your legal opinion today. If the Office of Professional Responsibility questions your objectivity and reasonableness, then I think we on the panel all should as well.
Meanwhile, several states across the country are writing their own bills challenging the constitutionality of the NDAA. The Virginia House and Senate have passed measures that would prohibit the state's National Guard from assisting the federal government in the military detention of an accused U.S. citizen. And the Utah legislature is considering a resolution to formally condemn Congress for passing the NDAA and call on them to repeal the indefinite detention provisions. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
During the violence of the Khmer Rouge regime in the late 1970s, tens of thousands of Cambodians fled to nearby Thailand. Some went on to the Philippines and then to the U.S., where families resettled and tried to start over. But about a decade ago, the U.S. stepped up its deportation of Cambodians who had been convicted of aggravated felonies, forcing many to leave the U.S., the only home they've known. Many of these exiled Americans now reside inside Cambodia. A group of them have made a short film called My Asian Americana that they're using to advocate for changes in the U.S. policy. One of those involved is Kasal Kiv.
And if the world is black and white, then let me bring the color. And if the world is black and white, then let me bring the colors.
That's a clip from one of his poems, Why I Write. Kiv was born in a refugee camp in Thailand before moving to the U.S. with his family. At the age of 17, he was charged with attempted murder in connection with a gang fight. He served 14 years of a 16-year sentence before being released in 2011 when he was deported to Cambodia. He joins us now from Phnom Penh. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you on the program. You begin this poem describing your journey from a refugee camp in Thailand. How did your family get there, and how did you get to the U.S.?
Well, during that time, it was after the war, and my mom was pregnant with me in 1980. And at that time, I was living in Battambang, in the countryside in Cambodia. Well, my family was. And a lot of people that escaped, I call the exodus, you know, they escaped through the borders of Thailand because it was the closest vicinity. So from Cambodia, my mom, my three brothers, my three sisters, and my grandmother made their way out to the border and was in a refugee camp called Kawadang. And there I was born there. From there, my family was relocated, as far as I know, to the Philippines. And from the Philippines to North Carolina, we were sponsored by a Christian family.
And how old were you at that time?
I was a year old.
Now, fast forwarding a bit, you're released from prison in 2011, deported back to Cambodia. What was it like to step off the plane in Phnom Penh to arrive in this country after so long?
I mean, okay, I'm here. It is. I'm tasting freedom for the first time after 15 years. You know, so it was mixed emotions. Definitely mixed emotions. So, coming into Phnom Penh, there was a storm, and I was scared. So this was one of the first times me flying long flight like this, and the turbulence and everything was so scary. And yet I had this feeling. It's kind of weird to like almost describe, because it's like a peaceful feeling, but yet filled with anxiety and filled with nervous energy of scared, nervous, excited, all mixed into one. And I remember landing and coming out and looking at like all these Cambodian people, like the most Cambodian people I've seen in my life. Like, and then like, as far as like looking out, I was like, wow, you know, I'm here, I'm free, but I'm not, because I was just so scared. I didn't know what to expect. You know, I was told I was going to be meeting a liaison for immigration from the U.S. side, and she would like fill me in on what it is that I'm going to go through. But once I was in the custody of immigration in the Cambodian immigration, she just basically left. I was thinking in my head, how do I get my ID? You know, I don't have an ID. I don't have any type of papers. I had no money, you know.
So authorities didn't help you with those basic things like what you're saying, getting an ID or money in your pocket to take that next step?
They didn't do anything. They basically shipped me out, parachuted me out there and said, here, we're done with you. You know, I was the product. They made a product and decided that this product is no good. You know, and shipped me out there with nothing. And to me, how inhumane it is that it's a death sentence. And there are exiled Americans that was deported out here that has no family, no friends, you know, mental health issues. There's, you know, so what happened to them? You know, it's like I'm the fortunate few. But how about the ones that don't have anything? And that's a death sentence.
Kasal Kiv, you're now part of this effort with other exiles in Cambodia and the group Studio Revolt to advocate for changes to the U.S. deportation policy for Cambodian Americans. What are you calling for?
I think because most of the ones that are being deported back are refugees. You know, we're refugees. We're refugees of you know, I mean, here it is. All these refugees that came after the war, you know, were being placed in low-income housing. The integration of, you know, no English, no nothing, just after a horrific genocidal war and placed in America with no type of support or help. Of course, there are some that got help and support, but there's many that didn't. We're out of their hands. That's it. But here it is. You're like sending us out of here, you know, with nothing. Why?
Kasal Kiv joined us from Phnom Penh, Cambodia. Thank you for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And you can hear an extended interview with Kasal Kiv and watch a video of his poetry on our website, fsrn.org. In Somalia last night, a journalist with a local radio station, 49-year-old Abukar Mohamed Karaf, was shot and killed outside his home around 6 p.m. Mohamed Ibrahim, Secretary General of the National Union of Somali Journalists, told FSRN from Mogadishu that the radio station Mohamed Karaf had been working for was raided by al-Shabaab, the militant group linked to al-Qaeda, in 2010, and Karaf had been trying to get the station back on the air. Ibrahim described the climate for journalists in the country after repeated murders.
The journalists are very worried about the culture of impunity, which, you know, the terrorists are still, you know, has not been brought to court, has not been punished for what they have done, and they are able to kill other journalists as well. So that is the worry, that, you know, the most of the, you know, worrisome trend which is facing the reporters here in Mogadishu.
According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, Mohamed Karaf had worked for several civil society organizations and advocated for peace. He has a wife and four children. Somalia is one of the most dangerous places in Africa, and in its capital, Mogadishu, residents have been enduring warfare for more than a generation. For those who report on the country's events, the situation can be especially difficult. According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, 4 media workers have been killed in the past 6 months. The UN Special Representative for Somalia has called for a full and independent investigation into the killing of Kadhafi. In a statement, Agustin Mahiga called on the transitional federal institutions to redouble their efforts to end the culture of impunity and halt what he called an unacceptable cycle of violence. You're listening to FSRN. Stay with us. Today, protesters in the Occupy movement are drawing attention to the corporate influence in lawmaking, with events planned in some 70 cities nationwide. The focus is on the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, a group of corporate lobbyists with deep ties in D.C. Protesters in Oregon and Southern California are targeting Walmart. In New York's Bryant Park, the focus is on Bank of America and the Koch brothers. And in Salt Lake City, protesters are marching on the state capitol and highlighting private prisons in the state. Groton, Connecticut is also one of many places around the country where demonstrations are taking place. In this case, to draw attention to the pharmaceutical giant Pfizer, FSRN's Melinda Tuhus reports.
Rise and shine, 99, now it's time to occupy. Rise and shine, 99.
Dozens of Occupy activists from cities and towns all over Connecticut converged on a park by Long Island Sound at 8 a.m. As seagulls wheeled in a gray sky, they got ready to march to Pfizer headquarters about a mile away.
Now it's time to occupy. Rise and shine, 99.
Jason Morris of Occupy New London said the group had sent a notice to Pfizer asking for a meeting and demanding that the company cut all ties with ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council.
The things that come out of ALEC are things like staving off medical healthcare reform, killing labor rights, all kinds of basically right-wing agendas. So Pfizer is a member of it, and they've been pushing things like extending the patent lengths so that generics won't come to market when they're supposed to by law, so that they're affordable by the masses, and so that they can continue profiting off of the patented medications that they've come up with.
Another participant was Patricia Olexi, a member of Occupy Shoreline, which represents 8 middle-class towns east of New Haven. She said she got involved last fall when a neighbor came to talk with her about income inequality and the Occupy movement.
That's what our main focus is, reaching out to our neighbors and tell them that we understand the hardship that they go through. We're going through it as well. We're not trying to overthrow anyone or take anything over. We just want the system to work for everyone as a whole so that our government can continue to run in some form of progressive fashion that helps society as a whole, the people that they were sworn to take care of when they took office as government officials.
ALEC and Pfizer sitting in a tree, writing bills to oppress me.
When marchers reached Pfizer, a guard turned them away from the main gate. Pfizer did not grant their request for a meeting, so they walked around the whole complex, stopping at each gate and asking to speak with company officials. A lawyer for the protesters said police arrested between 7 and 9 people. The activists plan to spend the afternoon at a teach-in at a local church. Melinda Tuhus, FSRN, Groton, Connecticut.
In Florida, a bill that could increase the number of people who lose their homes to foreclosure has advanced in the state house. The measure would allow lenders to file summary judgments in foreclosure proceedings as soon as 20 days after issuing a delinquency notice to homeowners. It cleared its final committee in the Florida Senate this week, and today the measure was passed in the Florida House. FSRN's Janelle Irwin reports.
The bill would allow lenders to hasten foreclosure proceedings in certain circumstances, including homes that have been deemed abandoned. Supporters say the legislation is needed to address Florida's massive foreclosure backlog, which ranks among the worst in the country. It's being dubbed the Florida Fair Foreclosure Act, But opponents see it as anything but fair.
I don't think it's appropriate to expedite foreclosure and come down so hard on our hardworking neighbors.
Congressmember Kathy Castor has been trying to help Florida's struggling homeowners for a few years. Castor says some homeowners just need a little breathing room on their mortgage payments to get back on their feet.
They want to stay in their home, and they've made payments year after year, but some circumstance like a lost job or reduced income has hit them hard.
Castor noted one problem is that banks don't often have sufficient documentation at the start of the foreclosure process. The Florida foreclosure bill does address that by requiring lenders to file the mortgage note simultaneously with the initial complaint. Some homeowner advocates are also concerned because the bill shortens the amount of time homeowners have to catch up with their payments. But the slow pace of the current legal process is what allows many people to save their homes. William Sanchez, the Tampa Bay Community Development Corporation vice president, says legislation like this bill could limit the time agencies have to help people avoid foreclosure.
The banks are taking so long to decide on the modification, so the less time that we have to work, and if the banks continue to take that time that they're taking, it's going to be a big struggle for us to be able to get any type of resolution. Anything that's going to hamper our situation right now, it's going to be hurtful because there's a lot of people that have need out there. And one of the things that we've been relying on is the ability to have the time to be able to work something out. If that time is cut short right now, it's going to give us less ability to do anything. And you know, we will see more foreclosures, which is something that we don't want to see.
Homeowners who seek help often have to wait a long time before being accepted into programs. That was the case for Tampa resident Lee Holton, who applied to be in a federal program called Hardest Hit, which will give him 6 months of help with his payments.
I think total was 4.5 to 5 months, and we are our first month in the program, and excited to see what happens after this six-month program.
That program only applies to homeowners who have suffered a hardship, like the loss of a job, through no fault of their own. Opponents of the foreclosure bill also say it sidesteps a federal regulation that prohibits Florida from transitioning to a non-judicial foreclosure state. Marquez McGee from the Corporation to Develop Communities of Tampa said that provision would be bad news for homeowners.
The state of Florida has what is called a judicial foreclosure process. And what this piece of legislation may do is to change it to a non-judicial foreclosure process like those states in like Georgia, Virginia, and such. And so that would cut down on the amount of time because the mortgage company does not have to, quote-unquote, sue the homeowner to take back the property.
The bill does include some provisions for people who have already lost their homes. It shortens the amount of time lenders have to collect money that is still owed on the house after a foreclosure is final. What is called a deficiency judgment can now only be collected within 1 year. Castor says that's a start.
The economy is getting better. The unemployment rate is down. The stock market hit a high note yesterday. Small businesses are more confident these days, but we still have a lot of work to do in the Tampa Bay area and all across the country, particularly when it comes to housing.
Supporters of the bill claim it will not make situations worse for struggling homeowners because the bill mostly addresses homes that have been abandoned. But opponents say the provisions for determining which homes qualify as vacant are too vague and only need claims from neighbors and 3 visits by a liaison who determines no one lives there. Janelle Irwin, FSRN, Tampa.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kamp. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening today. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.